Hello, I am Ruda Landman, host of the So What podcast, in which political economic analyst JP Landman takes a deep dive into one South African issue at a time. Whether it's load shedding, corruption, politics, economics, foreign policy, or anything in between, this is where you will find facts and insights to make informed decisions. The So What podcast, published monthly on all major platforms.
Welcome back to episode 149, The Serial Crimes of Rosemary Ndlovu. This is part three of this episode. If you haven't listened to part one and two, go back and do that now, and then come back here. This episode is sponsored by the upcoming release movie, Asphalt City. First responders are vital components of well-handled crime scenes, and paramedics are almost always one of the very first to encounter some really traumatic and dangerous situations. On the 29th of March, Asphalt City, a brand new film, hit our big screens in South Africa, which takes you deep into the underbelly of this honourable and often difficult profession. Ollie Cross is a young paramedic assigned to the New York City night shift with an uncompromising and seasoned partner, Gene Rutkowski. Each 911 call is often dangerous and uncertain, putting their lives on the line every day to help others. Cross, played by Ty Sheridan, is guided through the dark night shifts in a city clearly in crisis by Rutkowski, played by Sean Penn. Soon, their experiences start to test their relationship and the thin line of ethics they walk between life and death. Last week, we launched a giveaway on CCSA's social channels, and I've got the names of the winners for you. Kerry Lynn and Emmerine Simon, congratulations. You've each won a set of double tickets to watch Asphalt City, and your popcorn and drink are complimentary too. I hope you have an incredible time watching Asphalt City. If you weren't lucky enough to win free tickets, hop online and book your tickets now. Asphalt City released on the 29th of March, and it's epic.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
In parts one and two of this episode, we saw Rosemary Ndlovu beginning her murder series with the unproven allegations that she may have played a role in the deaths of her first husband and son. Then, we looked at the first murders she committed, which are proven in a court of law. The murder of her cousin, witness Khomu, and her only full biological sister, Audrey Ndlovu. In total, these murders netted Rosemary close to 1 million rand from various life and funeral policies, which she'd fraudulently acquired. Another thing that becomes quite apparent is that Rosemary most definitely used her job as a police officer to ensure that very little investigation went into these two latter murders. But really, and sadly, it doesn't seem like she actually had to do much to achieve that. Witness and Audrey's murders seem to just get swallowed into the annals of the approximately 84 people murdered in South Africa every day. They were, for the most part, completely forgotten by those who had committed to serve and protect them, at least until much later on, when a few incredible SAPS members would commit to convicting their murderer. Rosemary had an interesting relationship with men. She was undoubtedly independent, and if that was all, there would be no problem. But from many reports of her relationships with her first husband, as well as Maurice Mashaba, Rosemary was rather abusive in her relationships, which should probably come as no surprise. It is widely believed that by 2015, Maurice Mabasa, Rosemary's partner, had started to suspect that she was coming in some money through means which were illegal. Rosemary, as we've learned, was not big on sharing, so it's likely most of this money benefited her alone, and she wouldn't have gone out of her way to spoil Maurice. Maurice's brother, Justice, told journalist Naledi Shange that his brother was getting ready to leave Rosemary. He had told Justice, "I no longer want to be part of this woman's life. She thinks she can kill me, but she can't." Maurice had spent 5 years in Rosemary's world, and it seems he'd had enough. Justice explains that Maurice was trying to set up a way out. The way he describes Maurice quietly going about setting up a backup plan, arranging a new flat he could move into and not telling Rosemary about it, or that he was planning on leaving until he was ready to go, reminds me of the way we advise abused spouses to safely leave their abusive partners. Maurice spoke as though he was courageous, but he was clearly afraid of what Rosemary might do if she found out he was planning on leaving. And he had every right to be scared. Introducing a child to an already difficult relationship often makes things worse. Yeah, sorry to break it to you, but kids don't fix relationships. The strain of having a child and adjusting to a new lifestyle often ends up being the final nail in the coffin. And in 2014, Rosemary Ndlovu had become a mother again. Her first child, Jaunty, had died at 13 years old in 2008. And after 5 years together, Rosemary and Maurice had had a baby girl, Makanani, together. The pregnancy, it seemed, had been very intentional. Rosemary had apparently gone as far as to have fertility treatments to increase her chances of falling pregnant. Perhaps somewhere in Maurice, he'd hoped a child might bring back the very early days of their blissful happiness together, but the relationship only got worse. In October 2015, Rosemary arranged several new life and funeral policies on Maurice. This time, rather than posing as her victim over the phone, she went as far as hiring a man to pretend to be Maurice so that when a salesperson from the life insurance company came to their house, they believed they were speaking with the insured person. In this way, she was able to have the policies appear to have been taken out by Maurice himself. This was an added layer of prevention she hadn't taken in her previous crimes, and also shows that there were others involved in her crimes. Whether or not these people knew the reason for the ruse is unknown, but Rosemary didn't pull all of this off on her own. Her new baby would likely be the reason Rosemary gave, if anyone ever asked, why she needed all of these policies for Maurice all of a sudden. They had a child now. They needed to ensure that the child was provided for, should anything happen after all. Of course. In that same month, she followed up on several other policies to ensure they were paid up to date. Those that were behind were quickly paid up. On the 14th of October 2015, the brutally beaten and stabbed body of Maurice Mabasa was discovered in Olifantsfontein. He had been severely beaten and stabbed more than 80 times. He was wearing his work clothes. Maurice's wallets containing bank cards and 300 rand in cash was still in his pants pocket when he was found. It was clearly not a robbery. Justice received a telephone call from Olifantsfontein police station informing him that he needed to come to the police station immediately. He could hear a woman screaming and wailing in the background, and he only realized when he got to the station that it was Rosemary, and his brother had been murdered. As with the other victims in Rosemary's life, Maurice's body was discovered and his case was wrapped up pretty quickly. Wrapped up, not solved. It was believed that he'd been killed on the evening of the 14th of October. The scene was really not very far from the home he'd shared with Rosemary. The scene was photographed and Maurice's body was removed. Police worked the scene overnight looking for evidence. Maurice had sometimes not come home. His brother would say that it was because he was afraid. And when that happened, Rosemary, ever possessive, would call around to his friends and family demanding to know where he was. But on the evening of the 14th, when Maurice didn't return home from work, she didn't do that. In fact, she didn't ask anyone at all if they knew where Maurice was, not even his brother. Instead, she dressed her infant daughter and on the morning of the 15th went straight to Olifantsfontein police station to report her partner missing. She opened a missing persons docket and was on her way out of the SAPS office when a pair of detectives entered. By chance, they were the same two detectives who had just been on the scene of Maurice Mabasa's murder. One of them actually had a bag of evidence with them from the scene, including Maurice's wallet and bank cards, but the bag was not see-through. And this is pretty important, because the minute Rosemary saw the two men and the bag of evidence, she fell to her knees and started screaming that her husband was dead. She would later claim that being a police officer, she knew what the evidence bag meant, and she'd put two and two together. Now, I have no idea what that means, because an evidence bag and two detectives do not, in anyone's mind, equal a dead husband. But apparently in Rosemary's mind it does. The prosecutor would later point out, though, that Rosemary had very likely been watching the scene of her husband's murder and seen the two detectives there. It's the only way she could have known that those two detectives were working a murder. And the only reason she'd known where to watch would be if she had knowledge of where Maurice had been murdered. Rosemary alternatively offered as an explanation that she'd actually received a call from someone who knew her and worked at the police station to tell her Maurice was the murder victim they'd found, and that's how she'd known. She could not identify this person, though, so neither excuse really added up to much. Rosemary had become so hysterical outside the police station that it seemed she'd forgotten her six-month-old baby was strapped to her back, and she'd flung herself to the ground. The officers had to act quickly to pluck the child from her to avoid her getting hurt. Unfortunately, none of the officers present seemed to think that this was suspicious and put it down to Rosemary being a grieving widow. Maurice's death would be the only funeral Rosemary would contribute any significant amount of money to, and I can only think that this is because it gave her a stage. She fully pretended to be a hysterical grieving widow at the funeral too, and also because the quality of Maurice's funeral would directly reflect on her, as she was his partner at the time and the mother of his child. After Maurice's death, Rosemary received more than 400,000 rand from various policies. She paid 40,000 rand for his funeral. Justice would later explain that when his brother had been murdered, That had actually been the fourth attempt on his life that year. The first had been when a knife-wielding man had attacked him in the grounds of his home as he arrived home from work one night. The man had fled when Maurice had begun to shout for help. The second incident was when a gun-wielding man had once again approached him in his driveway, aimed his gun at Maurice, and pulled the trigger. But the gun had jammed, and the man had run away. The third incident was inside the home he shared with Rosemary. Maurice believed he'd been drugged, and as he lay in his bed, the bed had been set alight. The fourth incident, of course, was the one that killed him. And perhaps these prior failed attempts explain the intense overkill evident in Maurice's murder. It also brings into the picture the matter of possible hired hitmen. Despite having a ton of money, Rosemary also apparently had a bit of a gambling addiction and very expensive tastes, so it was not uncommon for her to be indebted to loan sharks. She was also known to associate with men who were known criminals in the community. She would claim that this was part of her police work, but her superiors would later say it most certainly was not. We know for sure that Rosemary killed Audrey herself, but witnesses' murder, that of Maurice, and others to come were very possibly committed by hired hands. It is quite astonishing that so many people had direct knowledge of what Rosemary was doing, and it all went completely unseen for so long. Besides the life and insurance policies, there was also a payment from Maurice's employer. He'd worked as a chauffeur at the US Embassy, and a policy his employer had paid out to Rosemary had also held money in a trust account, which paid out monthly for baby Makanani. But the little girl would not live long enough to continue receiving these payouts. Shortly after Maurice's death, Rosemary began phoning his elderly mother and complaining that baby Makanani was very upset and would not stop crying. She convinced the woman that it would be helpful if she would care for the child for a while. Maurice's mother was happy to do so. It helped her with the grieving process to have her late son's child in the home. One day, though, Rosemary showed up without notifying the woman and told her she was taking the child home. The next thing Maurice's family knew, they were told that the young child was dead. Little explanation was provided for her death. Rosemary said she'd got sick and died. The Mabasa family only found out after her funeral that she'd died. Justice believes that Rosemary poisoned the baby to gain access to the remaining money in the trust fund. Unfortunately, as with Jaunty, toxicology in Makanani's death was inconclusive. In 2022, Justice says that something emerged which totally blew them away as a family. His sister admitted that the fertility treatment Rosemary had had to fall pregnant with Maurice's child was not just fertility treatment, but also in vitro fertilization. The embryo had been fertilized outside of Rosemary's body and then implanted into her. The sperm that was used did belong to Maurice Mabasa, but the egg was not Rosemary's. It belonged to Maurice's sister. Rosemary had begged the woman for her help, saying she was desperate to fall pregnant but could not conceive naturally. So baby Makanani was essentially a product of scientific incest. There's absolutely no doubt that Maurice had not known that his sister's egg was being used, and Justice believes that Rosemary would have used her superior education and manipulation skills to convince the less sophisticated sister that either they would not be using Maurice's sperm, or that because there was no sex involved, it didn't count as anything biologically dangerous. The woman explained that Rosemary was very convincing, and a lot of the time she was actually not sure what was happening. She remembered papers being signed at the hospital, and the next thing she knew, she was going through the egg harvesting process. It all happened so quickly, she only had time to think about it properly afterwards. What's the actual why? Why was Rosemary so absolutely desperate to have a child with Maurice Mabasa just 6 months before she murdered him? Why would she want to risk having a child with physical difficulties by using Maurice's sister's egg? And why, after all of that, if Makanani's death was indeed another of her mother's crimes, why would you murder the child? There's no information about whether there were any policies out in Makanani's name, but perhaps there didn't need to be anything additional. The child died soon after her father, and that trust fund that was set up by his employer still had a significant amount of money in it when she died. All of that was then paid out to Rosemary Ndlovu. It's not often that I'm completely gobsmacked by a case, but this is one of those moments. How far does Rosemary's planning go? How cold is this woman? It just beggars belief. Of course, I must say that Rosemary has never been charged with or convicted of Makanani Mabasa's murder, but by 2016, Rosemary was once again a widow and a grieving mother. And if this litany of bloodlust should have sated the woman for a while, having netted close to 600,000 rand in 2 years from the deaths of her husband and daughter, that clearly was not nearly enough for Rosemary. Sanele Mota was technically Rosemary's niece, but as far as I can tell, there was no blood connection between the two. Zanele was from Rosemary's stepfather's branch of the family and born to a child of his first wife, so although there is a familial tie, there doesn't seem to be a blood link. But a familial tie was more than enough for Rosemary. By 2016, Zanele was the mother of 3 children, and she was living in Johannesburg with the father of her children. It becomes clear in the disparate versions around Zanele that Rosemary enjoys trying to make her victims look like people who were involved in questionable behavior before their deaths. She did that with Witness too. Of course, creating stories like that always helped to explain terribly tragic deaths. So there are 2 stories about how Zanele came to be briefly living with her aunt Rosemary in 2016. Rosemary claims that Zanele's partner had kicked her out of the house because she was an alcoholic and going on binges where she would disappear for days at a time. Her partner denies this vehemently and says that Zanele only went to live with Rosemary briefly because she promised to help the woman gain access to an inheritance she was allegedly due. Now, whether or not this inheritance actually existed remains to be seen, but that does sound very much like a story our con woman of inheritances would come up with to lure an unsuspecting victim to what would ultimately be her death. In fact, I can just imagine Rosemary starting to phone up Zanele quite out of the blue and planting seeds. "Did you get the money your father left you when he passed away?" she might ask. Zanele, none the wiser, would answer in the negative. "Oh, well, that's just unacceptable," Rosemary might say. "You must come visit me. Just you, mind, not the children, and I'll use my contacts to make sure you get your inheritance." Utterly grateful and undoubtedly eager for any extra money, being a mom of 3, Zanele would likely have immediately rushed out to her aunt's home, and she would never make it back home to her babies or partner. In a sequence of events that strangely resembles the death of Jaunty 8 years before, on the 13th of June 2016, Zanele Mota was taken to Tembisa Hospital by her aunt Rosemary. The young woman had allegedly been struck by someone riding a bicycle. Her injuries were not particularly severe, but there were abrasions all over the woman's body. 24 hours later, Zanele was discharged into Rosemary's care. She was supposed to take her hospital file down to the pharmacy, get some pain medication, and then hand her file in. But that never happened. Instead, the file went back home with Rosemary and Zanele back to Rosemary's house. 2 days later, on the 16th of June, Rosemary arrived at Arvape Hospital in Kempton Park, the same hospital where Jaunty had been treated, with an unconscious and severely beaten Zanele. Emergency room staff did all they could to save Zanele, but she died within a few hours of being admitted. In her autopsy, it became clear that the young woman had sustained a horrendous beating. She had multiple bone fractures as well as major damage to her liver, undoubtedly from being repeatedly beaten in the stomach or lower back. Rosemary claimed the injuries had been sustained in the bicycle encounter on the 13th. She claimed that she hadn't taken Zanele to the hospital on the 13th at all. She said Zanele had been drinking heavily and had often just disappeared from her home when she'd been staying with her. On the 13th, she said, she'd been called to Tembisa Hospital and found her niece there, very drunk and almost incoherent. Rosemary said that even when she came to collect the woman the next day, she was still intoxicated and therefore could not tell the doctors that she was still in fact in terrible pain. But she'd insisted on leaving the hospital, so Rosemary had complied. At home, she says Zanele began to deteriorate from what she claims were the untreated injuries, and by the time she got her to Arvape, she was beyond help. Now, the autopsy report on Zanele Mota was clear. Her injuries were most certainly not consistent with being struck by a bicycle, even if that bicycle was moving at top speed for a human cyclist, which is unlikely on a busy city street. In addition, Tembisa Hospital still had the digital versions of the x-rays taken, and they showed no broken bones. But 3 days later, Zanele had broken bones. The doctors at Tembisa Hospital said that if Zanele had had the type of liver trauma which had contributed to her death at the time they'd seen her, even if she was intoxicated, which according to them she was not, when they did a physical checkup and pressed on her stomach, she would not have been able to bear the pain that came with that action, and they would have been alerted to internal damage. It just wasn't possible that she was discharged in the same condition she died in. Rosemary, though, insisted that this is what had happened and shrugged her shoulders. Rosemary admitted that she'd had a funeral policy for Zanele. She actually had three. They were valued at 60,000 rand, but because Zanele had died of unnatural causes, that amount immediately doubled. Rosemary claimed that she'd taken these policies out because her niece was an alcoholic and living a risky life, and according to her, it was inevitable that something bad was going to happen. Rosemary would claim that she'd paid 60,000 rand towards Zanele's funeral, but this could never be confirmed. Zanele's partner spoke to author Naledi Shange about a further betrayal by Rosemary toward him and a resulting terrifying prospect of Rosemary's future plans. Zanele and her partner were not married and had three children together. This had never really been an issue to her family, but after her death, Rosemary told Zanele's partner that the children should come and live with her. She, amazingly, called on cultural tradition to back this up. In many African cultures, if a man impregnates a woman and does not marry her, he must pay damages to her family. This had never been a discussion with Sanele's family, but after her death, Rosemary was suddenly demanding that Sanele's partner either pay damages or give up the children to her. The children's father refused. He was already deeply suspicious of the role Rosemary may have played in Zanele's death, and he was concerned for his children's safety if they lived with her. He stood up to Rosemary and told her she could take him to court if she wanted to, but he was keeping his children. Rosemary, of course, knew that no court would remove the children from the care of their biological parents unless he was negligent or abusive, and he was neither. So she backed down, and the man never heard from her again, until he would sit in a courtroom years later as she was convicted of Zanele's murder. In a way, I don't even want to think what Rosemary had in mind for Zanele's children. The damaged money was a clear desire, but she knew Zanele's partner didn't have money to pay that, and it probably wasn't what she actually wanted. Horrifyingly, the children would probably be worth more to her. Not as human beings, of course. She hadn't even wanted her own children after all, but rather as life insurance and funeral policies. Let that sink in for a moment. Just the horrific possibility of that as a plan. Rosemary may not have gotten Zanele's children, but she wasn't finished with her branch of the family. After Zanele's death, many of her family members noticed that her younger brother, Willie Mashaba, was in constant contact with Aunt Rosemary. Many were already deeply suspicious of Rosemary suddenly showing up in their lives and how Zanele had died, and warned Willie to stay away from the woman. Unfortunately, Willie did not heed the warnings. Two of the young men's friends would eventually be very important witnesses in this case. They were able to confirm that Rosemary had been the last person to be in contact with Willie before what would ultimately be his murder. On the 9th of April 2017, Willie was with his two friends at a tavern when his phone rang. He put the call on loudspeaker, and his friends heard him greet the caller as Aunt Rosemary, and the woman greeted back. It seems that Rosemary soon realized she was on speakerphone, though, and told Willie to move away from the people he was with and take the phone off loudspeaker. He complied, and of course, his friends did not hear the rest of the conversation, but when he got off the phone, he told his friends he was going to meet his aunt in Davyton, and he left. It was the last time his friends would see him alive. Cell phone data would later place Rosemary and Willie in the same place together on that day. Rosemary did not deny seeing her nephew, but claimed she'd only met with him to give him some money he'd asked to borrow from her. She claimed she'd then dropped him off at a taxi rank as he wanted to go see his grandmother in Pretoria, and that was the last time she'd seen him. Willie Mashaba, though, never made it to his grandmother's house, if, in fact, he was ever headed there. Instead, his body was found in a field in Gasfontein, Pretoria, the next day. He'd sustained a single gunshot wound to the head. His cell phone was in his pocket, and the responding detective pulled it out and dialed the last called number. Rosemary Ndlovu answered. The detective told the woman that he was at the scene of a murder of a young man and he needed her to come through and identify the victim. He'd only managed a few steps of the directions before Rosemary interrupted and said she knew exactly where he was and she'd be there soon. The detective was taken aback, as he hadn't really given much to go on, and within 15 minutes, Rosemary was on the scene. Considering she lived in Tembisa and had intimated to the officer that that's where she was, that in itself was strange, as a car trip from Tembisa to Gasfontein is at minimum 33 minutes. Later, it would be put to Rosemary that she'd once again staged the quick recovery of the body to speed up the process of identification and that she'd known very well the detective would dial the last called number on Willie's phone and she'd in fact been waiting nearby for that call. Rosemary, of course, denied this. In fact, she bizarrely claimed that she'd never even been on the scene at all, and the detective had to have called out someone else entirely and mistaken that person for her. Zanele and Willie's family had lost two members in the space of 2 years, and not to illness or accident, but to horrible, disturbing circumstances that seemed to have one commonality, Rosemary Ndlovu. A woman who was supposed to be the victim's aunt, but many now suspected had instead become their murderer. Rosemary had funeral policies in Willie's name, but things were starting to shift out of the woman's favour. In the background, there were a few people who suspected that Rosemary was killing her family members and claiming policies. At least one of those people was a police officer who'd started investigating her, and so when she tried to claim the policies on Willie's life, she found her way blocked. The companies said they'd been advised not to pay out until the SAPS's investigation was complete, and they were complying with that instruction. It's not uncommon for serial killers to continue killing even when they know they're being suspected of murder, and Rosemary was no different. Whether it was her own overinflated ego or a desperate need to taste the ultimate control that murder gave her one more time, Rosemary Ndlovu would take yet another victim before the long arm of the law finally started to close in around her. Rosemary's next, and hopefully last, murder would be inextricably linked to her second, that of her only full biological sibling, Audrey, in 2013. Brilliant Mashego had been Audrey Ndlovu's only son. He was just 4 years old when his mother realized it was impossible for her to care for him and also work and earn money, and she'd taken him to live with his paternal grandmother in Bushbuck Ridge. The Mashego family had said the Ndlovus had never really played much of a role in Brilliant's life. When Audrey was murdered, Brilliant was just a teenager. At her funeral, he was told by Rosemary that he should work hard in school because there was money that his mother had left for him to study. The young man was intelligent and had excelled in school, and when he matriculated, he expected his aunt would come through with the money for his studies, but he'd been ignored, and instead, his grandmother on his father's side took out a loan to help him get started with his studies while he applied for bursaries. She paid it off with her state pension. Brilliant eventually started taking piece jobs and tried to continue studying at the same time. By 2018, he had a young child with a woman he intended to marry as soon as he could afford to, but he'd also been hearing some rumours through the family grapevine about things that had happened when his mother died, and he made contact with his Aunt Rosemary. Brilliance had heard from a few people that Rosemary had come into a large amount of money after Audrey had died. He thought perhaps his aunt had spent the money his mother had put aside for his education, but he likely soon started to realize that the situation was far darker than that. By then, though, it was too late. Brilliant's grandmother and his partner said that in the last weeks of his life, the young man had become very secretive. When his phone rang, he left the room, and they eventually figured out he was talking to Rosemary. His grandmother warned the young man not to get involved with the woman, but Brilliant insisted that his aunt was helping him and everything would be okay. On the 24th of January 2018, Brilliant Mashego was found murdered in a marketplace near Bushbuck Ridge. He'd been beaten so severely that he was no longer recognizable. He had been bound, and finally a sharp object had been used to pierce his skull and brain, which killed him. Rosemary, of course, had several life and funeral policies out on Brilliant, but it seems she was getting sloppy. Instead of just insuring Brilliant as her nephew, she'd put him down as her son. And when it came time to prove that relationship in order to claim, she, of course, could not provide a birth certificate with her and Brilliant's name on it. None of the policies paid out. Now, this may be completely beside the point, but really, if the insurance companies had just asked for this proof up front, perhaps things could have gone a little differently. Probably not, because Rosemary would likely have just gone to another insurance company and put him down as her nephew, but it is painful to see how little care was actually put into the application end of this policy when it ended up leading to a young man's death. Brilliant's grandmother, who had raised him, was completely devastated at the loss of her grandson, and her pain was only made worse when she contacted the Ndlovus for assistance with his funeral. On the phone, Sophie Ndlovu, Rosemary's mother, had told the woman not to bother her with things that had nothing to do with her family. Brilliant was Sophie's grandson. He was Audrey's son. He had been the only child of Sophie's own murdered daughter. One would think that would count for something, but apparently not. It would be cell phone evidence as well as testimony from Brilliant's grandmother and partner that would eventually tie Rosemary to his murder. He had told both women he was going to see Rosemary when he disappeared, and his cell phone and Rosemary's cell phone had travelled together for much of the 24-hour period before his body was found. Rosemary claimed this had all been a coincidence, and that her and Brilliant just happened to be in the same taxi, and when she last saw him, he was alive and well. No one was convinced. With her last two murders failing to net Rosemary any money, the woman was deep in debt to loan sharks. The men were coming to her place of work, demanding the money owed to them, and it was making life incredibly difficult. This was when Rosemary had decided that she needed to commit another murder, one that would be almost the most horrendous she'd committed yet, and it would lead to her downfall. Because just a few days before Rosemary thought she'd conducted a successful business meeting with two hitmen to arrange to commit the next murders on her list, those two men walked into a police station and told detectives they had a story to tell about a woman called Rosemary Ndlovu. And that is where I'm going to leave part three. Yes, I'm afraid there's going to have to be a part four, because there's still quite a bit of info to relay about Rosemary Ndlovu. The only other case that's gone into four episodes was the Van Breda family murders, So maybe that says something about people who kill their family members. I don't know. I'll be back as soon as possible with that final installment. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.